Welcome back to our study in Bunyan's The Pilgrim's Progress. Last time we left off with the fellowship of Christian and Faithful with Evangelist, their evangelist and discipler, who brought them great refreshment after a number of unfruitful conversations. At the end of their interaction, after some exhortation and encouragement, Evangelist, it warns or explains, tells Christian and Faithful that they're about to go to a town where they're going to be hard-pressed with trial, and that they're even going to face death. Well, today we come to the town of Vanity and the fair that's kept there all year round called Vanity Fair. This is where that phrase began. Bunyan's name of this town, this fair, Vanity Fair, I think to this day remains a magazine title, which shows how influential Bunyan has been and also how worldly our society continues to be. So it says there's this fair kept all year round called Vanity Fair because the town where it is kept is lighter than vanity. That's a reference to Isaiah chapter 40, verse 17, that I'll read for you. Isaiah 40 and verse 17, all the nations are as nothing before him, him being God. They are regarded by him as less than nothing and meaningless. This is what God thinks of all the nations as in terms of their renown and their glory and their splendor and their worthiness. They're meaningless, they're vanity, they're lighter than vanity. What is the town of Vanity and what is Vanity Fair? It's a picture by John Bunyan of the world. It's a striking illustration of this present world system and worldliness as it goes with it. 1 John chapter 2, verses 15 to 17 tell us that we must not love the world. Do not love the world, John says, nor the things in the world. If anyone loves the world, the love of the Father is not in him. For all that is in the world, the lust of the flesh and the lust of the eyes and the boastful pride of life, is not from the Father, but is from the world. The world is passing away and also its lusts, but the one who does the will of God lives forever. There's this really stark contrast between the way of the Father and the love of the Father and the way of the world and the love of the world. James 4, verse 4, you adulteresses, don't you know that friendship with the world is hostility toward God? Therefore, whoever wishes to be a friend of the world makes himself an enemy of God. And so you simply cannot have any mixture of Christianity and worldliness and the world. And what Bunyan does here is he gives us an illustration of what happens when the light comes into conflict with darkness, when Christians come into conflict with the world. He says, now this fair is no new erected business, but a thing of ancient standing. I'll show you the original of it. Almost 5,000 years ago, there were pilgrims. 5,000 years from 1670s would be pretty much in the time of the patriarchs, 3500 BC or so. So about 5,000 years ago, there were pilgrims walking to the celestial city, as these two honest persons are now. And Beelzebub, Apollyon, and Legion, with their companions, perceiving by the path that the pilgrims made that their way to the city lay through this town of Vanity, they contrived here to set up a fair. So the enemies of righteousness, the demons and the devil, realize that the way to heaven has to lie through the world, that there's no other way to get to heaven but by living in the world. And so what they did to the world is they made it a circus. They made it a carnival. They made it a fair, wherein, Bunyan says, should be sold all sorts of vanity, emptiness, meaninglessness. And it should last all the year long. It just never stops. It's a never-ending circus. Therefore, at this fair are all such merchandises sold. And listen to this list of the things that Bunyan counts as the things of this world. Things sold as houses, lands, trades, places, honors, preferments, titles, countries, kingdoms, lusts, pleasures, and delights of all sorts as whores, bawds, wives, husbands, children, masters, servants, lives, blood, bodies, souls, silver, gold, pearls, precious stones, and what not. What a list that is. And one of the things that strikes me about that list is that there are some pretty clear sinful things in themselves, like whores. And then there are some things that are not sinful in themselves, like wives, husbands, and children. What's Bunyan saying? He's saying that the things of this world that are even lawful for us to obtain and enjoy, like family, can be perverted into vanity by making idols out of them, by treasuring your husband or your wife or your children above God, by revering them and submitting and obeying them rather than submitting to and obeying Christ. We can take any good gift from our giver and pervert them into competition with our giver rather than thanking him as the great giver and benefactor via all these gifts. We can turn what should be a conduit for his praise into a competitor for his praise. And when we do that, and the world tempts us to do that, Vanity Fair tempts us to do that, we turn those things into vanity, and so even good things can become vanity. And moreover, at this fair is at all times to be seen jugglings, cheats, games, plays, fools, apes, knaves, and rogues, and that of every kind, just every kind of distraction and diversion in the world that would take your mind off of spiritual things, of things of consequence, things that are weighty. And he says, here to be seen too, and that for nothing, are thefts, murders, adulteries, false swearers, that of a blood-red color, all sorts of sins taking place in the world. And it's interesting, then he has a comment about how there are all sorts of streets in the town of Vanity, and there's Britain Row and French Row and Italian Row and Spanish Row and German Row. Each nationality, each ethnicity, each nation has its own course of worldliness, its own brand of worldliness. And, you know, people will take pride in belonging to one or another group which sins in their own way. That's not where the Christian is to find his identity. It's not in his ethnicity or his heritage or his culture. It's in Christ and in the scriptures alone. But he says, then, as in other fairs, some one commodity is as the chief of all the fair. So, you know, in some fairs, there's like a special attraction. So the ware of Rome and her merchandise is greatly promoted in this fair. Only our English nation, with some others, have taken a dislike thereat. So he's saying, speaking certainly of 17th century England and Europe, that the chief merchandise of worldliness is Roman Catholicism. And that's a severe comment upon the apostasy that is Romanism. The Catholic religion is not Christian whatsoever. It is paganism baptized in Christian language, and it makes the gospel into anti-gospel. It makes Christ into anti-Christ. And Bunyan saw that very clearly. But interestingly, he says, it's not so much the case in England, because what did England do in the late 16th century, mid-16th century? They created the Anglican Church. And so he's saying that both Romanism and Anglicanism are here at Vanity Fair. And so he's making a comment on the worldliness of both of those religions. Now, there are certainly evangelical Anglicans. There are certainly saved persons who don't know enough to come out of the Catholic Church, but we pray that if the Holy Spirit is in them, they will come out soon. So it's not to say that everybody, you know, in those, you know, under the broad banner of those religions is lost, but those religions, those, you know, systems of religion by their own documents, by their own, you know, testimony, belong in the world and not on the side of the Lord of the way, Christ. Bunyan, severe commentary on both Romanism and Anglicanism. Now, as I said, this is still Bunyan speaking. The way to the celestial city lies just through this town. You simply can't get to heaven without going through the world. Where, and he says, and he that will go to that city and yet not go through this town must needs go out of the world. It's a reference to 1 Corinthians 5:10. I'm not saying you shouldn't associate with the immoral of the world. Then you'd have to go out of the world. This is what we are. We, are, as Christians, are not called to go out of the world. Christ sends us into the world. In fact, in John 17, in his high priestly prayer, he prays to the Father for us, for that very thing, that he would equip us, though we are not of the world, to nevertheless be in the world. John 17, 14, I have given them your word, and the world has hated them, because they are not of the world, even as I am not of the world. But I do not ask you to take them out of the world, but to keep them from the evil one. And so eventually he says, I send them into the world. So we're sent into the world, but we're not to be of the world. And in fact, Bunyan says, the Prince of Princes himself, Christ, when here, went through this town to his own country. So Christ dwelt in the world. Not even Christ himself was able to be spared from the pollutions of the world, which is not to say that he was polluted by them, but that he had to exist among them. And he was not shielded or safeguarded from all the corruptions of this fallen world. He says, yea, and as I think it was Beelzebub, the chief lord of this fair. So the devil is the lord of the world, right? The whole world lies in the power of the evil one, 1 John 5:19. It was Beelzebub, the chief lord of this fair, that invited Jesus to buy of his vanities. Yea, he would have made him lord of the fair, would he but have done him reverence as he went through the town. And that's a reference to the temptation of Christ in Matthew 4 and Luke 4, where Satan takes Christ to the top of the hill and shows him all the kingdoms of the world and says, this I'll give all to you. If they're in my power, it's in my power to give. If you just but bow down and worship me, all shall be yours. And Christ sends him away with a quotation of the scriptures. Yea, because he was such a person of honor, Beelzebub had him from street to street and showed him all the kingdoms of the world in a little time, that he might, if possible, allure that blessed one to cheapen and buy some of his vanities. But he had no mind to the merchandise. I love that comment about Christ's withstanding temptation. It's not that Christ was sorely tempted and that he was just, oh, in his heart, he was yearning after, I would love to be the king of all these kingdoms. Because the Father had already promised that he would have the nations for his inheritance, Psalm 2, 7, and 8. And so he knew that all was to be his. And he knew, therefore, that for Satan to be offering those things to him was something that he had no power to offer, and that there was no joy in, no lasting satisfaction in, because he would have them by his Father's promise, not by his enemy's promise. You shall worship the Lord your God and serve him only. So he had no mind to the merchandise. This is a picture of what the esteem of the righteous one should be of all the things most highly treasured in the world. It should be a low thing in our eyes what men of this world highly treasure and prize. And therefore, Christ left the town without laying so much as one farthing upon these vanities. He never sinned. Now, these pilgrims, as I said, must needs go through this fair. Well, so they did, but behold, even as they entered into the fair, all the people in the fair were moved, and the town itself, as it were, in a hubbub about them. And so they come in, and everybody starts saying, who are these people? Oh my goodness, come look at this guy. Oh my, wow, who are these? And then it says, for three reasons. The pilgrims were clothed with such a kind of raiment, clothing, as was diverse from the raiment of any that had traded in that fair. They have different clothes, which is a comment, once again, upon the righteousness of Christ that was put on these two pilgrims at the cross. When they were saved, they were taken off out of their rags, given a change of clothes, and they were given a scroll, a seal, to assure them of their salvation. And that change of clothes was the righteousness of Christ, the perfect robe of Christ's own obedience. as well as they've both been outfitted with the armor to do battle with the armor of God, Ephesians 6. And so these people look different. They look different because they come in the name of a righteousness not their own. The people, therefore, of the fair made a great gazing upon them. Some said they were fools. Some said they were bedlams or mentally ill. And some said they were outlandish men. So first, they have different clothes. Second reason that they're all in a fervor over these people is that they wondered at their, just as they wondered at their apparel, so they did likewise wonder at their speech. So there, you know, 1 Corinthians 2, 7 and 8 speaks about how Christians are standing out from the world, which regards us as foolish. And it says, but we speak God's wisdom in a mystery, the hidden wisdom, which God predestined before the ages to our glory, the wisdom which none of the rulers of this age has understood. For if they understood it, they would not have crucified the Lord of glory. So we speak the wisdom from above that the world doesn't understand. Our speech is unintelligible to the crowd of the world. They couldn't understand what they said. Naturally, Christian and faithful spoke the language of Canaan. They spoke the language of the promised land. They spoke the language of heaven. But they that kept the fair were the men of this world, so that from one end of the fair to the other, they seemed barbarians each to the other. We just don't speak the same. And thirdly, but that which did not a little amuse the merchandisers was that these pilgrims set very light by all their wares. They cared not so much as to look upon them. The Christian and faithful don't even look upon all the trinkets and things that all these merchandisers are selling. And if they called upon them to buy, they would put their fingers in their ears and cry, "Turn away mine eyes from beholding vanity," which is a quote from Psalm 119, verse 37. Turn away my eyes from looking at vanity. And that's the response. I wonder if you can hear some of your own life and see some of your own life in the example as Christian and faithful do battle with the world, as they have their interaction with the world. Is it plain that you wear the robe of Christ's righteousness? Well, you say, how is that the case? I mean, that's forensic righteousness. That's a declaration of my legal standing. Well, your justification does evidence itself in sanctification. The truthfulness of your position is made evident by how you're bringing your practice into conformity with your position. Do you stand out from the world? Can the world look at you and say, this is someone different? This is a righteousness, a clothing, a behavior, a conversation that's different than I'm used to? How about your speech? Does the world, do the people of the world listen to you speak? And do they say, oh yeah, here's someone who's right at home with us, speaks our language? Or does your speech stand out for its heavenliness? Does it have the accent of heaven on it? Are you speaking what is good and noble and true and praiseworthy and lovely? Or is your speech base and corrupt, foul and profane? And then, how do you esteem what the world esteems? Do you look upon what the world is selling and are you allured by it? Whether you purchase it or not, are you attracted to it? Does it have a pull on your affections, on your heart? Can people see plainly that what they prize so highly is of no account to you because you've set your heart on a greater treasure, on a better country, on a lasting city? These are questions that we ought to examine ourselves by. After the claim, turn away mine eyes from beholding vanity, it says they look upwards always, signifying that their trade and traffic was in heaven. And that's Colossians chapter 3, verses 1 to 4. Therefore, if you have been raised up with Christ, keep seeking the things above, where Christ is, seated at the right hand of God. Look, if you've been raised up with Christ, if you've been united to Christ in his death and resurrection, then keep seeking the things above where Christ is, not below where he is not. Set your mind on the things above, not on the things that are on earth. For you have died, and your life is hidden with Christ in God. When Christ, who is our life, is revealed, then you also will be revealed with him in glory. your life is in Christ, and Christ is not on this earth, he is in heaven. And therefore, set your mind not on the things below here, but above there. And then one other cause for the hubbub is somebody asked them, well, hey, what are you going to buy? And it says, but they, looking gravely upon him, said, we buy the truth, which is a reference to Proverbs 23, verse 23, which says, buy truth and do not sell it. Now at that, there is an occasion taken to despise the men the more, some mocking, some taunting, some speaking reproachfully, and some calling upon others to smite them, to hit them. At last things came to a hubbub, and a great stir in the fair, insomuch that all order was confounded. There's a riot. Now was word presently brought to the great one of the fair, who quickly came down and deputed some of his most trusty friends to take these men into examination, about whom the fair was almost overturned. So the men were brought into examination, and they sat up, and they that sat upon them asked them whence they came, whither they went, and what they did there in such unusual garb. And the men told them that they were pilgrims and strangers in the world, and that they were going to their own country, which was the heavenly Jerusalem, and that they had given no occasion to the men of the town, no reason for them to be upset with them, nor yet to the merchandisers to abuse them as they have, and to just let them go on their journey. Except it was for that when one asked them what they would buy, they said they would buy the truth. But they that were appointed to examine them did not believe them to be any other than bedlams and mad, to crazy people, or else such as came to put all things into confusion in the fair, or troublemakers. Either these people are nuts, or they're doing this on purpose. Therefore they took them and beat them, and besmeared them with dirt, and then put them into a cage, that they might be made a spectacle to all the men of the fair. They're pilgrims and strangers in the world. It's what I think I've said it before in these videos, but one of the things that we need to recover in the Christian life is our understanding of this world as not being our home, that the Christian life is a pilgrimage from here to heaven, that here we don't have any lasting city, but we seek a city which is to come, that we shouldn't be surprised when fiery trials come upon us if something strange were happening to us, because we're in a world that hates our master, that killed our master. If we were of the world, Jesus said, the world would love its own. But because you're not of the world, or because you are of me, because you're his, therefore the world hates you. We in our, especially in our nation, with all the blessings that we've had with religious freedom and even a Christian-like foundation, at least a outwardly Christian foundation of this nation, we've had the pleasures of having a wonderful time to see the religion of Christ flourish in the nation. Now the culture's tide is changing so greatly that all semblances of that are virtually gone. But I think that we've grown complacent, that we've said, look, we're going to set up life here on earth and we're going to feel really a whole lot at home, and everything is, you know, this is my home. I don't want to die yet. I don't want to go to be with Christ. We need to recover the fact that we should expect nothing in this world except the tribulations which Christ has promised. And whenever we don't have those, that is a blessing. We should expect that we will have them. And when we engage with the world, that there will be conflict. Well, they beat them, they besmear them with dirt, they put them into the cage, they're made a spectacle. I'm reminded of 1 Corinthians chapter 4, where Paul is speaking of the apostles, but I think this applies derivatively to Christians who follow in the way of the apostles. And he says, for I think that God has exhibited us apostles last of all as men condemned to death, because we have become a spectacle to the world, both to angels and to men. We are fools for Christ's sake. We are weak. We are without honor. To this present hour, we're both hungry and thirsty and poorly clothed and roughly treated and are homeless, and we toil, working with our own hands. When we are reviled, we bless. When we are persecuted, we endure. When we are slandered, we try to conciliate. We have become as the scum of the world, the dregs of all things. Here we see an illustration of that. These innocent men are persecuted. They're put into a cage and beaten. And there they lay for some time, and were made the objects of any man's sport or malice or revenge, the great one of the fair still laughing at all that befell them. But how did they respond to that? But the men being patient, and not rendering railing for railing, but contrariwise blessing, and giving good words for bad, and kindness for injuries done, some men of the fair, that were more observing and less prejudiced than the rest, began to check and blame the baser sort for their continual abuses done by them to the men. What's that saying? First, just consider their response. They didn't rise up and revile. They didn't cause a counter-revolution. They didn't insist upon, this is injustice, and you men are criminals, and you're wicked, and you know all these sorts of things. There was no reviling. There was blessing. Good words for bad, it says. Reminds of the Sermon on the Mount. Bless those who curse you. Bless and do not curse. Of Luke 6, which says, but love your enemies and do good and lend, expecting nothing in return, and your reward will be great, and you'll be the sons of the Most High, for he himself is kind to ungrateful and evil men. And so there is no, again, insistence upon justice. There is no insistence upon my own rights. There is no reviling. There is no rioting. There is the patient endurance of unjust suffering. And then what's the result of that? Some people at the fair, some people in the world, begin to see how the faithful servants of Christ bear up under unjust suffering. Not how they insist upon their own way, not about how they're champions of their own rights, but how they bear suffering, how they endure ill treatment. And some of those people in the world say, hey, guys, easy. You know, these men really haven't done anything. And then the world turns on them and says, oh, you shut up, you hush, you don't. And then there's a whole big angry fight among the world's people so that the world gets into a fight with the world. What you're seeing, it says, the other replied that for all they could see, the men were quiet and sober, intended nobody any harm. See, the light is shining in the darkness, and even the enemies of the light, when God gives grace, can't deny the light of the Christian way. Endurance of suffering, especially endurance of unjust suffering, is a strong apologetic to the world. The world doesn't really care about you know how well Jesus makes you rich and how many cars Jesus gives you and how big houses Jesus gives you. That's what they want. If Jesus is going to give you all that, I'll take Jesus, but it doesn't take the new birth to want that. It just takes greed. But what happens when they see genuine unrighteousness and injustice being perpetrated and we, like our Lord, when reviled, don't revile in return? When we suffer, utter no threats, but keep entrusting ourselves to the one who judges righteously, they look and they say, what kind of God strengthens such people to do that, to endure that kind of persecution and that unjustly? And then they begin to take notice. Well, they are brought before the examiners and they're charged as being guilty of that riot. So when the world fights the world, because they disagree about the men in the cage, then the men who are in the cage are blamed for inspiring that riot, which just shows you the injustice of the world. And so they beat them pitifully and hanged irons upon them and led them in chains up and down the fair for an example and a terror to others, lest any should further speak in their behalf or join themselves unto him. So they stomp out any sort of fidelity to these Christians. But Christian and faithful behaved themselves yet more wisely and received the ignominy and shame that was cast upon them with so much meekness and patience that it won to their side several of the men in the fair. So people are seeing this and they're interested in following after the Christ that Christian and faithful are following after. And this put the others into yet a great rage, insomuch that they concluded the death of these two men Wherefore they threatened that neither cage nor iron should serve their turn, but that they should die for the abuse that they had done and for the deluding of the men of the fair. And how backwards and upside down is the world, that the eternal benefit of the world is regarded by them, their own selves, as abuse. I remember not long ago where there was a young man who went to an unreached people group and was killed by them. And so many people, I'm not commenting on the wisdom of that approach to world missions, but some people responded to that young man's heroic, brave efforts of bringing the gospel to the people who would die and go to hell without it as hopelessly colonial and paternalistic. And they're saying he's going to go and impose his values upon this pristine, you know, indigenous tribe. They counted as abuse what would have only tended to that tribe's great benefit had they heard and accepted the gospel. And for deluding the men of the fair, only the world is so upside down and backwards as to call illumination delusion. The light of the knowledge of the glory of God in the face of Christ as delusion. And then they have the gall of leaping into the darkness of human rationalism and calling that enlightenment. The world calls evil good and good evil. And they remanded them to the cage again. And this is when they called to mind what they had heard from Evangelist. And they were the more confirmed in their ways and sufferings by what he told them would happen to them. And they also now comforted each other that whose lot it was to suffer, even he should have the best on it. Therefore, each man secretly wished that he might have the preferment. They remember what Evangelist told them. And they were comforted in the sense that, hey, he knew, and it's turned out the way that he said. And don't forget what else he said, that one of us was to die, at least one of us. And so then they started wishing secretly that they would be the one to die. I wonder if that's you or me in the cage, if we're so rightly thinking about heaven and the glories of heaven, that to live is Christ and to die is gain, that it's far better to depart and be with Christ, that we would secretly desire that our lives would be the ones taken. But committing themselves to the all-wise dispose of him that ruleth all things, with much content they abode in the condition in which they were, until they should be otherwise disposed of. And again, that's 1 Peter. I'll read those two verses that I think I've mentioned them already. But 1 Peter 2, verse 23. And while being reviled, he did not revile in return, speaking of Jesus. While suffering, he uttered no threats, but kept entrusting himself to him who judges righteously. And then 1 Peter 4, 19. Therefore, those also who suffer according to the will of God shall entrust their souls to a faithful Creator in doing what is right. And so again, no rage, no cries of injustice, no insistence upon one's own rights, but the gracious resignation to the will of God in all things, to suffer unjustly as Christ has, to follow his example by not reviling as he had not reviled, and to bear up under unjust suffering. Let me read that passage that I keep talking around, but forgetting to quote. For this finds favor, 1 Peter 2:19. For the sake of conscience toward God, a person bears up under sorrows when suffering unjustly. For what credit is there if when you sin you're harshly treated, but you endure it with patience? But if when you do what is right and suffer for it, you patiently endure it, this finds favor with God. Suffering is inevitable, Christian. And when you interact with the world and you look different and speak different and don't run after the things that they love, they will, because the darkness hates the light, come upon you and persecute you and maybe even put some of us to death. In those times, whatever suffering we experience, it falls to us to endure it patiently as from the wise hand of God and to make much of the glory of his name by showing that he, faithfulness to Christ in suffering, is more enjoyable and satisfying than all that life could offer and all that death can take. When we do that, when, to me, to live is Christ and to die is gain, then will Christ be magnified in my body, whether by life or by death. Well, we're not quite through Vanity Fair. Come back next time for part two.